Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading. Hi, my name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of today's Cape Cod Times. Today's date is Wednesday, March 6th of 2024, and we'll start with the weather as we always do. Across the Cape and Islands today, you can expect it to be mostly cloudy with a little rain in the afternoon, high of 51. Tonight, mild with rain, increasingly heavy throughout the night, a low of 42 expected. Tomorrow, Thursday, rainy and breezy in the afternoon with a high of 47 and a low of 35. Friday, times of clouds and sun, high of 40, a low of 36. Saturday, low clouds, high of 40, low of 37. So we have two nice days on Friday and Saturday. Sunday morning rain, otherwise cloudy and breezy, high of 46, low of 35. Sunrise today was at 6:07 a.m. It will set at 5:38 p.m. We'll have 11 hours and 31 minutes of daylight, a reminder that we are about to spring ahead this weekend. So be prepared to set your clocks ahead, the ones that are manual, and don't do it digitally. Just an FYI to remind you. The moonrise will be at 4:05 a.m. or was at 4:05 a.m. just a few minutes ago. It will set at 12:55 p.m. Heading to the front of the paper, where the news and, of course, the lottery results are kept. And we read these lottery results because somebody asked for them. If there's something you would like read to the blind or those who are print disabled, you can email us at info@audiblelocalledger.org or call us at 508-539-2030, and we'll consider reading it. And if you miss any of the information that we share in our readings, you can always go to audiblelocalledger.org, and in the upper right corner is the Archived Readings tab. Click on that, you'll find a week's worth of our newspapers, and you can catch up on anything you might have missed. Our shopping guides are up there as well, so you can see what savings await you at the grocery store. And under our literature tabs, you'll find a wide variety of periodicals and literature for your listening enjoyment. All of that is free for people who are blind and print disabled at audiblelocalledger.org. Now, for the latest results, we go to masslottery.com because the Cape Cod Times goes to press too early to give you the latest results. And if you ask for them, you certainly deserve the latest results. So for the numbers game of Tuesday, March 5th, in the midday drawing yesterday, the numbers were 1, 7, 6, 1. Yesterday's midday drawing, again, 1, 7, 6, 1. The evening drawing last night, 9, 3, 3, 7. The numbers game drawing in the evening for Tuesday, March 5th, 9, 3, 3, 7. Mass cash results for Tuesday, March 5th, 14, 20, 25, 26, and 31. Mega Millions for Tuesday, March 5th, 2, 49, 50, 61, and 70. 14's the bonus number. And finally, Lucky for Life rounds out our lottery results for Tuesday, March 5th with 7, 17, 22, 25, and 43, with 11, the bonus number. Good luck to all who play. Remember us if you win. Heading to the front page of today's Cape Cod Times, the headline above the fold, if there was such a thing in a digital newspaper, reads, "At the polls for Super Tuesday, voters say democracy, economy, immigration are all on the ballot," by Denise Coffey in Buzzards Bay. Born resident Phil Murphy finished breakfast at Leo's Breakfast Restaurant Tuesday morning and made his way to the polls at the Veterans Memorial Community Center a few blocks away. As he walked through the mist to cast his ballot, he offered thoughts about the election. "I just hope Donald Trump doesn't get in," he said. "He tried to overturn the election. He lied about everything. He lies about everything." Voters at the polls in Bourne, Sandwich, and Harwich shared their thoughts on Super Tuesday morning about Trump and President Joe Biden, along with what they think the most important issues are this election. Those issues, according to voters, included immigration, border control, the economy, and a need to preserve democracy. By 8 a.m., About 60 people had turned out to vote at the community center, according to Precinct 1 Warden Edwin Smith. He oversaw a team of volunteer election workers. "There's always hype with elections," he said. "It's just different hype. People get excited." Later in the morning at the Corpus Christi Parish Hall in East Sandwich, a steady stream of voters pulled in and out of the large parking lot. Deborah Bales was one of them. Bales, who's 63, isn't happy with what she called an invasion of immigrants in the country illegally. She said half of her husband's paycheck is going to taxes, and she wants Trump back in office. "He's done a lot for our country," she said. "I'm not a Trump lover, but I do love his politics, and we need big changes." David Contney, a former U.S. Air Force Chief Master Sergeant, said he voted because he had served in the military. "We have men and women serving all over the world to allow us this privilege," he said. "I think we should get out of our chairs to come out in the rain." Paul Houlihan said there were a lot of issues on the table in this election. "The first is we have to keep our democracy," he said. "Second, because of all the social justice issues that need to be addressed, immigration, minorities, poor people. They aren't the enemy. Immigrants have made this country, and they'll continue to make this country." Nearly 400 Harwich residents had turned out to vote at the community center by 10 a.m., town clerk Emily Mitchell said. "The four town precincts included 11,701 voters," she said, "and a steady stream of people had passed through the doors since opening at 7 a.m. "It's been steady to busy," she said, standing behind a bench of poll workers. About 30 of them were on hand to handle registrations, check-ins, and check-outs. For Richard Omar, the biggest issues were border control and the economy. "America's going down the drain," he said, "especially border control. Everyone in the Middle East is laughing at this president because he's not doing anything. We didn't have these problems when Trump was in office." Monomoy High School students run the exit poll. John Dixon, a civics teacher at Monomoy Regional High School, had brought a group of his students to conduct exit polls at the center. It's a tradition that goes back to 1998. Between three classes, he estimates the students poll a couple of hundred voters. "It's a valuable experience for them to have conversations with voters," Dixon said as he watched the students question a couple who came out the door. "It makes politics real." Dixon stepped in to ask a woman a series of questions his students were asking. "What party are you in? And who did you vote for? Who will you vote for in November? What are the most important issues in this election?" Grace Filliman said she was a Republican. She voted for Trump and expects to vote for Trump in November. The most important issues were between the border and the economy, she said. Harwich clerk Mitchell smiled when she heard Dixon and his students were outside conducting exit polls. She participated in one when she was a senior at Monomoy. "It was great to see the democratic process in action," she said when asked what she got out of the high school experience. "It helped me develop the confidence to speak with people, to have an honest communication about democracy." Massachusetts was one of 14 states holding elections on Super Tuesday. Registered voters on the Cape joined people in 14 other states and one territory, casting ballots for the presidential candidate they want to represent their party on Election Day in November. Ballots also had slates of candidates for Democratic and Republican state committee man and woman for Democrats and woman and Republicans, voted by state Senate districts, as well as Democratic and Republican town committees. The Republican ballots had seven candidates, though only Trump and Nikki Haley were officially in the running. The Democratic ballot included Biden, Dean Phillips, and Marianne Williamson. The Libertarian ballot listed five candidates. All ballots gave voters the option of voting no preference for their party's presidential candidate. According to the Associated Press, Trump had 273 delegates and needed 1,215 more to clinch the nomination. Haley won one primary on Sunday in Washington, D.C., and last night Haley also won Vermont. So she has those two on her side. The rest all went to Trump. On the Democrat side, Biden had 206 delegates and would need 1,968 to clinch the nomination. Our next story, that's on the cover of today's Cape Cod Times, dated Wednesday, March 6th, has a headline that reads, $350 million in federal funds to help replace two bridges, by Walker Armstrong. After some back and forth between Republicans and Democrats in the House, U.S. lawmakers announced Monday that $350 million in federal funding has been appropriated for the replacement of the two Cape Cod Canal bridges, cementing a chunk of funding that officials say is crucial for securing the much larger package of money that's likely to come later this year. The money, which was initially proposed in a U.S. Senate appropriation bill last summer, was initially left out of the House's corresponding bill. But Democratic U.S. Representative William Keating, Democrat from Massachusetts, said it was ultimately included after some discussion between House Democrats and Republicans. This is an example of working across the aisle together in a House that's probably as divided as ever in this century, Keating said. This is one more major leap forward for the bridge projects. The replacement of the Bourne and Sagamore bridges, the largest and most integral infrastructure project for the region, will take place in phases, the first of which will focus on the Sagamore Bridge because of its higher traffic volumes. Keating said the $350 million will be for this first phase. This is a significant step toward completion of the Sagamore, but it's also important to recognize this money provides us more flexibility, perhaps moving ahead for the early stages of planning in the Bourne Bridge, Keating said. Last spring, President Joe Biden pledged $350 million in his fiscal 2024 federal budget, committing an additional $600 million for the following year. This $350 million is the pledge from Biden, coming from the fiscal 2024 Energy and Water Development Appropriations Bill, a Senate measure that provides $57.9 billion in discretionary spending for infrastructure projects nationwide. Governor Maura Healey's office announced on August 14th an application plan for securing $1.44 billion in federal discretionary grant money for the project. The Healey administration applied for $150 million from the nationally significant Multimodal Freight and Highway Projects Program and $222 million from National Infrastructure Project Assistance. These two grants were applied for alongside the Bridge Investment Program, which was the largest share at over $1.07 billion. The administration's application strategy is also backed by $350 million in matching state money, which mirrors the U.S. Senate's inclusion of the $350 million. The Healey-Driscoll administration recently included $262 million toward replacing the bridges in the state's fiscal 24-20 through 28 capital investment plan, altogether aiming to include $700 million in state money for the project. In December, $372 million of funding from a grant application that was filed by the state in August, which is part of the federal multimodal project discretionary grant program, was awarded to the project, representing the first round of guaranteed funding. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said Monday, "The funding from the congressional bills in the first grant program is a good indication that the project will be fully funded." This is a reminder of the way we get a big infrastructure project like this approved, in building blocks, not a single grant, Warren said. The single grant to cover a project of this size is just not there anymore. So it takes partnerships with the state and the federal government. Keeping it local, we'll move over to the Cape and Islands section in the Cape Cod Times for Wednesday, March 6th of 2024. The headline reads, "Cape Cod Groups Work to Prevent Suicide," by George Castinos, is a special to the Cape Cod Times. The issue of suicide and how to intervene to prevent it is a complex problem with no simple solutions, and as such, it's become a topic of serious societal concern all across the United States. In 2021, 12.3 million American adults seriously thought about suicide, with another 3.5 million who planned suicide, and another 1.7 million who attempted suicide, said Karen Ellery Jones, assistant director at the Samaritans on Cape Cod and the islands. She also reported the number of those who died by suicide was about 48,000. And there is great concern on Cape Cod as well. Cape Cod Community College is hosting a suicide prevention summit this week. The summit's focus is to raise awareness, promote education, and bring the community together to do more to reduce suicides. On Cape Cod, a great deal of work is currently being done by the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition, which includes several organizations that provide service through helpliners. Through helplines, pardon me. Along with Samaritans, Massachusetts Behavioral Health Partnership, the Trevor Project, Veterans Crisis Line, 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, Martha's Vineyard Urgent Behavioral Health Services, Nantucket Behavioral Health Advisory Group, and Bay Cove Behavioral Health and Wellness Center are members of the coalition. Samaritans receives 10,000 to 11,000 calls to its crisis line per month, Jones said. That's a lot of calls. But most of those calls, she said, are from people who aren't actively suicidal. Most people who call in simply don't have great support systems to help them manage their problems. They call to help get through the day. They need someone to talk to get through whatever crisis they're experiencing, said Jones. There are about 2 imminent calls per month. Samaritans receive only about 2 of those imminent calls per month, where the crisis line operators work to help get them to a place of safety, Jones said. However, all calls, she said, are deemed serious with a potential to become imminent if the caller can't get support. Even people who call in regularly might be fine, but then something happens that might trigger greater stress, said Jones. For every call, a risk assessment screening for suicide is done because they're calling a crisis line. The crises that people experience are varied. Some are very specific and very personal, such as domestic disputes, breaking up with spouses or significant others, the death of a loved one, chronic illness, and substance abuse. Other issues involve socioeconomic factors, those who experience financial insecurity, housing insecurity, or food insecurity, said Jones. And there are mental health issues. Maura Weir, a suicidologist who is the chief wellness officer at Cape Cod Community College and co-chair of the Cape and Islands Suicide Prevention Coalition, emphasized that suicide is an overall public health problem. It's not an individual problem, it's a community problem, Weir said. Feeling connected to the community is important to people, which is why the majority of calls to crisis lines are from people who just feel lonely. Loneliness and isolation are the breeding grounds for depression, said Jones. A lot of calls come from people who have very little support. They don't have friends or family. We are their connection. Because all calls are anonymous and phone operators don't know who's calling unless the caller provides that information, Jones said she wasn't able to give exact statistics regarding demographics. However, she said all kinds of people call in, men, women, some children, sometimes as young as 12 years old, all age groups, some LGBTQ, transgender, and non-binary individuals. From 2016 to 2020, there were 151 deaths by suicide in Barnstable County, based on studies that report on 5-year trends, Weir said, with 43, 2018 saw the highest number, and the lowest was 21 for 2019. The average was 30 per year. I'm happy to report a reduction in suicide deaths among youths, said Weir. In that 5-year span, there were only 2 deaths by suicide for the age group 15 to 19, she said. That number was a little higher at 8 deaths for the age group 20 to 24. The highest number of deaths by suicide was in the age group 45 to 54 with 34 deaths, and the age group 55 to 64 with 35. Across all age groups, it was found that men take their own lives in greater proportion to women by a ratio of 4 to 1. In addition, death by suicide was by far highest for white males, with 140 of the 151 deaths from 2016 to 2020. Nationally, Weir said the rate of death by suicide was also predominantly white males for those 85 years of age or more. Weir reported, though, that females attempt suicide in greater numbers than men. Men choose more lethal means of suicide, such as by guns or hanging, than females who generally use pills and alcohol, she said. With pills and alcohol, women are able to reach out before it's too late and they can be rescued, Weir said. Regarding race, white individuals by far had the most deaths by suicide on the Cape and Islands in Plymouth County, with 394. Black individuals were second with 11, Weir said. Barnstable, which is the largest of the 15 towns on Cape Cod, had the highest number of deaths by suicide, with 28, Weir said. Falmouth had 19, followed by Bourne with 16, Dennis with 12, Mashpee had 13, Sandwich had 11, and Brewster had 10. While it's still too early to determine the trends for the next 5 years, Weir was able to provide some statistics. In 2021, there were 31 deaths by suicide, with 33 in 2022 and 20 for 2023. A decreasing trend from the previous five-year period may be occurring, Weir said. I'm confident the next 5 years will be lower. The projected average looks to be around 27, she said. The trends, when measured by the rate per 100,000, appear to be decreasing as well. In 2015, the rate was 16.2. In 2016, it was 10.7, and raising to 15.7 in 2017 and 20.3 in 2018. But the rate dropped to 9.7 in 2019. When I look at the next trend, the rate's going down, about 10 in 100,000, Weir said. Weir and Jones both said they felt the work the coalition is doing has helped decrease deaths by suicide. Looking at prevention here, we have a committed governor and legislators working to be sure people can get services, said Jones. In Massachusetts, we're moving in the right direction. Cape Cod Community College in West Barnstable last fall was awarded a Garrett Lee Smith Campus Suicide Prevention Grant, which will provide the college with $306,000 to expand its infrastructure to better identify and intervene with students at risk for mental health and substance use issues before they reach crisis. 15 million people think about suicide. 50,000 actually die by suicide. 50,000 is still a lot, but it is a very small percentage, and that's a pretty good outcome, said Weir. We are making strides. We're making changes. If you need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's a hotline for individuals in crisis or for those looking to help someone else who might be. To speak with a certified listener, call 1-800-273-8255. Again, 1-800-273-8255. Crisis Text Line is a texting service for emotional crisis support. And to speak with a trained listener, you can text HELLO in capital letters to 741-741. Again, text HELLO to 741-741. It's free, it's available 24/7, and it's confidential. If you or someone you know is in crisis, you can also call the Bay Cove Crisis Hotline at 1-833-229-2683. Again, the Bay Cove Crisis Hotline, if you know someone in crisis, you can call that at 1-833-229-2683. For more information about suicide prevention and how you can help, you can visit suicideispreventable.com. The other story in the Cape and Islands section that's local has a headline that reads, Massachusetts Civic Learning Week is set for next week, by Heather McCarron. With a presidential election year underway, the effort is on to promote civic education and involvement among current and future voters. To that end, the Massachusetts Civic Learning Coalition, described on its website as a nonpartisan coalition of more than 60 nonprofits, educators, research institutions, universities, and others, is planning its fourth annual Massachusetts Civic Learning Week. The exclusively online event takes place March 11th through 15th and involves students, educators, policymakers, and community leaders. Its aim is to, quote, strengthen constitutional democracy by supporting the movement for a civic education and educating about how local, state, and federal government works and the different roles of individuals. This free event is open to the public, and the theme this year is 2024 and beyond, civic learning as a unifying force, said Karen Mazza of the League of Women Voters, Cape Cod area. Registration is just open for Massachusetts Civic Learning Week, which coincides with the National Civic Learning Week, and it's co-organized by the League of Women Voters in Massachusetts the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University and the Massachusetts Women of Color Coalition. Plans include virtual workshops and events throughout the week with sessions like Zoom with a Judge and From Civics to Career Readiness. Other sessions focus on the legislative process, AI regulation, presidential elections, and the youth vote. Sessions supporting educators include such topics as building media literacy skills and fostering civil discourse and assessing student civic learning. It's important to provide programs and resources that raise the visibility of the importance of civic learning and engagement, and that provides ways for students and community members to interact around civic learning, said Mazza, who chairs the Youth Service Committee for the League and is also the State League of Women Voters representative to the Massachusetts Civic Learning Coalition. Some of the sessions, she said, allow students to interact with judges and learn more about the court system, while others involve interaction with legislators. In our case, civic organizations interact with students and support them in understanding the importance of voting and how to promote it at schools and college campuses, Mazza said. Since the legislature approved the Act to Promote and Enhance Civic Engagement in 2018, Massachusetts has made great strides to improve civic education, she said, but it takes continued state support through funding of the Civic Project Trust Fund to maintain the resources for curriculum and professional development that allow schools to offer strong civic education programs. Civic Learning Week, Mazza said, creates more learning opportunities for students, and it also keeps the importance of civic learning and engagement visible, reminding us to continue to support it. Mazza is organizing a session titled The Power of the Youth Vote, which is scheduled for March 15th. The session emphasizes the importance of young people being engaged. Data shows that while the youth vote increased in the last presidential election, the voter participation of young adults between the ages of 18 and 34 is still a significantly smaller percentage of their numbers as compared to older voters, she said. The session will include a presentation by Kelly Siegel Steckler, a senior researcher from the Center for Information and Research about Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University, who will provide data about the difference in the youth vote. It's important that young people understand that when they vote for elected positions, they're hiring the people who will pass legislation and implement policies that will affect their future, Mazza said. Issues like the affordability of college and housing, the environment, women's health care, and a range of other issues that matter to their future. In a democracy, we need the participation of all people so that our government is representative of the needs of all people. The event is not just for students and educators. Community members are welcome to attend sessions of interest, she said. The schedule for the week lists the session and the intended audience. For people in the community, there are some sessions they say that they are for all, and some that they say are for families, and some that they say are for policymakers, Mazza noted. She said the opening session in particular, Get Involved, Youth and Adult Civic Leaders Share Their Experiences, may be of interest to community members who often think that students don't learn about civics anymore. This session, which is set for 10 to 11 a.m. on Monday, features a panel of youth leaders sharing their experiences in bringing about change on a whole range of issues, from mental health to youth voting and climate change. The efforts of organizers to promote civic understanding and involvement are lauded by legislators such as State Senator Becca Rausch, a Democrat from Needham, who last year pressed the Senate to increase civics education funding for state and local education officials. I'm so proud to see that the policy and financial investments we're making in civics education here in Massachusetts are yielding real results. I see it in our classrooms, in our school visits, in the emails I get from students across the state, and in conversations with my own children and their classmates, she said in a statement. A full schedule of Massachusetts events and a registration link can be found at Civic Learning Week, Massachusetts Civic Learning Coalition. And that is, if you wanted to go to that website, it is M-A-C-I-V-I-C-S MaCivicsForAll.org/CLW2024. Again, MaCivicsForAll.org, CLW2024. And national events can be found at CivicLearningWeek.org. The editorial note mentions Heather McCarron writes about climate change, environment, energy, science, and the natural world, in addition to news and features in Barnstable and Brewster. And you can reach her at H. McCarron, that's HMCCARRON, at CapeCodOnline.com, or follow her on X at HMcCarron_CCT. We are just past the midway portion of our reading today. Regular listeners are well aware that's when we move to the death notices and obituaries that are listed in the Cape Cod Times for that day. We have a page and a half of them today. Our first obituary in the Cape Cod Times, dated Wednesday, March 6th of 2024, is of Samuel D. Walter of Mashpee, who passed away peacefully at the age of 83 on March 1st. Sam was born in Baltimore, Maryland, and was a four-year Navy veteran serving on the USS Wasp, which was stationed in Boston, where he met his wife in 1959 when they were both 18 years of age. They married in May 28, 1961, in St. Kevin's Church in Dorchester. He learned his electrical trade in the Navy and was a licensed electrician, working for Boston Edison Company in Plymouth as a licensed electrician in the nuclear power plant. He retired from Pilgrim Station in 99 and then pursued a second career in Local 223 of the Electrical Union. Upon his retirement, Sam and Catherine traveled extensively, visiting all seven continents. Sam was a member of the Knights of Columbus and the St. Vincent de Paul Society and had a profound love for his Catholic faith. Sam and Catherine moved to Southport in Mashpee in 2002. He is survived by his wife Catherine and many who will miss him dearly. The family is deeply appreciative of the extraordinary care he received at Cape Cod Hospital. A funeral mass will be celebrated at Christ the King Church, 5 Job's Fishing Road, in Mashpee on Tuesday, March 12th at 11 a.m. The burial will follow in the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne at 12:45 p.m. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Christ the King Food Pantry Expansion, P.O. Box 1800 of Mashpee, Mass., 02649. We thank all the veterans who have served and sacrificed for our country. Thank you for your service. The next obituary is of Paul and Jane Corriveau of Pocasset. Paul J. Corriveau, born July 3, 1930, and Jane H. Corriveau, born November 3, 1930, passed away peacefully at home surrounded by family on February 28th and March 3rd, respectively. They were both originally from Southbridge, but had lived in Pocasset since 1976. Their love story would have turned 70 on the April 20th anniversary, and it included chapters for not only their 8 children, but also for their 40 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren, as well as countless other family and friends. They spent their lives devoted to their faith, their family, and above all else, each other, and they will be forever missed. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, March 12th, at St. John the Evangelist Church at 841 Shore Road in Pocasset. The interment will be private, and a visitation will be held from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Monday, March 11th, at the Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home, located at 40 MacArthur Boulevard in Bourne. In lieu of flowers, any donations may be made in their honor to the VNA of Cape Cod Hospice and or the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Our next obituary is of Janet Frances née Cobb Fahrenkopf, who passed on March 1st at the age of 93. Janet was born in Hyannis on July 23rd, 1930, and she was the wife of Richard R. Fahrenkopf, Sr., who predeceased her in 2011. Janet was a lifelong Cape Codder. After raising her family, she worked many years for Highline Cruises. She especially enjoyed talking with all the travelers. She loved animals, going to the beach, maintaining her beautiful flower and vegetable gardens, spending winters in Florida with her late husband Richard, and especially enjoyed spending time with her family and friends. She is survived by her 6 children, 18 grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, and many who will miss her. Services will be private. Any contributions in her memory may be made to the Animal Rescue League of Boston, located at 3981 Main Street in Brewster, Mass., 02631. The next obituary in the Cape Cod Times of Wednesday, March 6th, is of Eileen C. Corrigan of Centerville, formerly of Holyoke, who died surrounded by family members on February 28th at the age of 86. She was born in Holyoke on October 18, 1937. She was educated at Sacred Heart High School and was a 1959 graduate of the College of Our Lady of the Elms. In August 1960, she married John J. Jack Corrigan, to whom she remained married until his death in February of 1995. She is survived by many who will miss her dearly. Professionally, she served for many years as an educator in various capacities for the Holyoke Public Schools and for the schools of the Diocese of Springfield. Additionally, she was an adjunct faculty member at Westfield State College. Most notably, she was director of early childhood education in Holyoke, in addition to principal of several of Holyoke's elementary schools. She enjoyed the things in life that most of us do, including travel, the beach, family, friends, and good conversation. She was an avid reader of mysteries as well as an amateur painter. She was particularly adept at crossword puzzles and could easily finish the New York Times Sunday puzzle in under an hour. The funeral will be Saturday morning, March 9th, this Saturday, at 9:30 from the Barry J. Farrell Funeral Home, 2049 Northampton Street in Holyoke. It will be followed by a funeral mass at Blessed Sacrament Church at 10 a.m. The interment will occur immediately thereafter at St. Jerome Cemetery, and calling hours will precede the funeral from 8:30 to 9:30 on Saturday morning at the funeral home. Following committal at the cemetery, friends and relatives are cordially invited to a luncheon at a location to be announced. The next obituary is of Robert Henry Silva, known as Bob, of Hyannis, who at the age of 81 passed on February 28th. He was cherished husband of Elizabeth Betty Silva, with whom he shared 57 years of marriage. Visiting hours will be held at the Doane Beal and Ames Funeral Home at 160 West Main Street, Hyannis, this Friday, March 8th, from 4 to 7 p.m. A mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at Our Lady of the Assumption Church on Wiano Avenue in Osterville on Saturday, March 9th, at 11 a.m. The burial will take place at the Massachusetts National Cemetery on Monday, March 11th, at 12:30 p.m. Due to the limitation of flowers at the cemetery, Bob's family requests that you consider a donation to the Barnstable Association for Recreational Shellfishing, the BARS, shellfishing.org. Tunnel to Towers Foundation at t2t.org, or St. Jude Children's Research Hospital at stjude.org. Bob Silva was a veteran, and we thank him for his service. The final obituary is another veteran, John P. Alberico of South Yarmouth, formerly of Watertown, who passed on March 2nd. He was beloved husband of the late Josephine Alberico, or Alberico. He was loving father of Bruce and his wife Camille, John and his wife Marion, David and his partner Michael, and Sandra Alberico of South Yarmouth. The funeral will be from the DeVito family, the DeVito Funeral Home, 761 Mount Auburn Street in Watertown, on this Thursday, at 9 a.m., followed by a funeral mass at 10 a.m. in Sacred Heart Church. The burial will follow in St. Patrick's Cemetery. Relatives and friends are invited to visit in the funeral home on Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in memory of John to the ALS Association, 1300 Wilson Boulevard, Suite 600, Arlington, Virginia, 22209, or online at als.org/donate. And that concludes the obituaries and death notices that are listed in the Cape Cod Times for Wednesday, March 6th of 2024. Our goal here is to keep giving you local news, and sports counts as local news when it's time for playoffs and teams are doing great in their local towns. So, keeping it local, from the sports section, the headline reads, Sophomore starting five leads John Paul II girls hoops to a Sweet 16 win, by Andre Sims of the Cape Cod Times. It's the playoffs. Of course you need experience. When the season reaches this stage, oftentimes the most experienced players are the ones who step into the spotlight. They've been there, and they've done that, and that knowledge almost always pays dividends. Well, almost always. The number 9 St. John Paul II girls basketball team advanced to the Elite Eight after beating the number 25 Academy of the Pacific Rim Dragons 60-46, and the Lions, 17-6, are led not by seniors, but by sophomores. They're a symbiotic bunch, all complementing each other. Collectively, they have their team in the MIAA Division V state quarterfinals. But make no mistake, this isn't your everyday group of sophomores. They've already got back-to-back 15-win regular seasons and have established a reputation for winning ways. But relatively speaking, they don't have much in the way of postseason experience. What's driving them is a bond that extends beyond the hardwood. The sophomores. The Lions starting five, Marlo Jumper, Reagan Dillon, Michaela Enright, Caitlin Lawson, and Devin Crawford, all sophomores, took on the lion's share of the responsibility in the win. We're like best friends at school, Crawford said. We're the starting five, and that's our friend group at school, too. Jumper got the team started. She came out firing in the first quarter, scoring 9, and helping her team build a lead that reached as high as 10 points. But this is the playoffs, and nothing is straightforward. Though facing a lower seed, the Lions were facing a Dragons team that's already taken down one top 10 team this postseason. An up-and-down first half played out, and the Lions entered the break with just a slim 22-20 lead. During the second 16 minutes, Crawford took control. Crawford led the Lions with 23 points, including 14 in the second half. She stepped up offensively, helping her team pull away, and has been one of the team's best scorers all year long. Crawford's 14 second-half points fueled a second-half surge that saw the Lions turn a 22-20 halftime lead into a 14-point win. By the second half, we kind of gotten an idea how they play defense and how they play offense, and then it was a lot easier to adapt to, Crawford said. She got going, and simultaneous, the Lions tightened the screws defensively, and the result was a combined effort that saw them pull away for good. I think it started on defense because they had two really good players, and by locking them down, it opened opportunities on offense, Jumper said. And then, by spreading the ball and working it around, we opened up shots. JP2 head coach Gus Adams said he was proud of the way his team managed what was a difficult playoff matchup. The Dragons were a fast-paced team, capable of scoring at all levels. It was a game that required careful management as each team took turns going on runs. You can get in your head when they're knocking down some shots and they're working hard, Adams said. You think you've got them on the ropes and then they come all the way back, so yeah, I thought they handled it well. They presented unique physical and mental challenges for the Lions and even held John Paul II scoreless for a period across the end of the first quarter and first half of the second quarter. But the second half was a different story. The tale of two halves. After just 7 second quarter points, JP2 dropped 21 in the third quarter and 17 in the final frame. The starters combined to score 56 of the 60 points in the game, and Adams believes the simplicity of the Lions' style, plus the bond of his starting five, created the winning environment that's them, has them amongst the last 8. They all give you something, Adams said of his starters. We're not doing a lot of fancy things offensively or defensively. Just go play ball with your friends. In addition to Crawford's team-high 23 points and Jumper's 17, Dillon added 10, and Lawson finished with 5 while Enright played her usual standout defense. The quintet already has over 30 wins to their names in their young career and have now gone deeper than they ever have in the postseason. Maybe the best part is there's still so much yet to come. We all work so well together, and we have two more years after this together, so we're just going to continue to build up, Jumper said. Editorial note, Andre Sims covers high school sports for the Times. And in the high school roundup, Brianna Brom breaks the Dennis Yarmouth record in the Northeast New England Championship by Courtney Jacobs. The 36th annual New England Interscholastic Indoor Track and Field Championship took place on March 2nd at the Reggie Lewis Track and Athletic Center. Dennis Yarmouth Jr., Brianna Brom, that's B-R-A-H-A-M, placed third in the girls' 300-meter at 39.62 seconds, breaking her own school record and recording a new personal record. Brom also placed 10th in the girls' 55-meter prelims at 7.28 seconds. Barnstable senior Lily Dedeco came in 15th place for the girls' 2-mile with 11 minutes, 26 seconds. She currently holds the Barnstable winter track mile record at 5 minutes, 14 seconds, and 2-mile record at 11 minutes, 20 seconds. Dedeco was also undefeated in the Cape and Islands League in both events this season. Nauset junior Madeline Mahoney finished 8th in the girls' 1,000-meter with 3-minute, 3-second, 1,000-meter. In other high school playoff action in girls' basketball, Division 5, Sweet 16, as you just heard, St. John Paul II, 60, number 25, Academy of Pacific Rim, 46. In boys' hockey, in Division 4, Sweet 16, it was number 2, Nantucket, 3, number 15, Bourne, 2. The Whalers, 17-4-1, are headed back to the Elite Eight for the third straight season with a comeback win over the Canalmen, 14-7-1, on Sunday. Division 4, Sweet 16. Number 24, Ashland, 5. Number 8, Martha's Vineyard, 3. Again, we're in boys hockey. The Vineyarders, 10-10-2, season ended in the Sweet 16. They beat number 25, Greenfield, 10-0, in the round of 32. And in girls' hockey, in Division 2 of the Sweet 16, number 4, Nauset Monomoy, 4. Number 13, Sandwich, 0. The Warriors, who are 19-2, are going to the Elite Eight for the first time in program history as they beat the Blue Knights, who were 11-11-2. Julia Kipperman, Sienna Reeves, Sophia Boucher, and Gabby Bassett each scored a goal for the Warriors, and they'll face number 5, Algonquin, on Wednesday. And that concludes all the local news that we find in today's Cape Cod Times of Wednesday, March 6th. So we'll move to some national news. Financial markets. Wall Street slumps to the worst day in weeks. Bitcoin touches its 2021 record before tumbling, by Stan Coe of the Associated Press in New York. Tumbling big tech stocks dragged Wall Street to its worst day in 3 weeks on Tuesday. The S&P 500 dropped 1% for its second straight loss after closing last week at an all-time high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 404 points, or 1%, and the NASDAQ Composite led the market lower with a 1.7% slide. Apple's drop of 2.8% was one of the heaviest weights on the market. It's been struggling on worries about sluggish iPhone sales in China, where tough competition and a faltering overall economy are challenging it. Apple is one of several big tech stocks that's bent recently under the weight of much higher expectations after running much higher in price. Since the start of last year, a select group known as the Magnificent Seven has been responsible for the vast majority of the S&P 500's run to all-time highs. Drops for several of them were among the heaviest weights on the S&P 500 on Tuesday. For example, Microsoft fell 3%. Amazon slid 1.9%, and Tesla dropped 3.9%. Piling into tech stocks has become one of the most popular moves on Wall Street among both mutual funds and hedge funds, according to strategists at Barclays Capital. They can raise the risk of sharp drops later when the momentum breaks, particularly with criticism rising that prices have gotten too expensive. High-growth stocks have generally been rallying for several reasons, including a frenzy around AI technology, that's artificial intelligence. But if they fail to deliver in aggressive expectations, growth investors will likely wind up disappointed, according to the asset allocation team at GMO, which is the investment firm co-founded by Jeremy Grantham. MicroStrategy fell 21.2% after it said it will raise $600 million in debt, which it will use to buy more Bitcoin and for general corporate purposes. Bitcoin briefly rose above $69,000 Tuesday, surpassing its record, which was set in 2021, before pulling back below $63,000. It's been surging in part because of new exchange-traded funds that offer easier access for investors to the cryptocurrency. It roughly tripled over the last 12 months, but it is notorious for huge swings in both directions that can happen painfully and suddenly. Target helped limit the market's losses after climbing 12%. It reported a bigger jump in profit for the end of 2023 than analysts expected, as it held the line on some expenses. The next headline, credit card late fees to be capped, by Daniel DeVise of USA Today. The typical late fee on a credit card payment will drop from $32 to $8 under a new rule announced Tuesday by federal regulators. Alleging that banks profit handsomely from excessive late fees, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has capped them at $8 for the largest card companies. Regulators estimate the cap will save American families more than $14 billion a year in late fees, or $220 per year for each of the 45 million people who pay them. Banking industry leaders counter that the cap could trigger higher interest rates for those who pay their bills on time. For over a decade, credit card giants have been exploiting a loophole to harvest billions of dollars in junk fees from American consumers, said Rohit Chopra, director of the federal agency. Today's rule ends the era of big credit card companies hiding behind the excuse of inflation when they hike fees on borrowers and boost their own bottom lines. The rule stems from the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility, and Disclosure Act of 2009, known as the CARD, C-A-R-D, Act, which banned credit card companies from charging excessive fees, among other reforms. Under the CARD Act, banks were supposed to charge late fees only to recover their costs in collecting the tardy payments, but regulators left a loophole. Card issuers could skirt the rules if they charged no more than $25 for a first late payment and $35 for subsequent late fees. Inflation adjustments pushed those sums to $30 and $41, respectively. The CFPB is now closing the loophole, and it's eliminating future inflation adjustments for card issuers with at least 1 million open accounts. The banking industry greeted the rule change with skepticism. Today's flawed final rule will not only reduce competition and increase the cost of credit, but will also result in more late payments, higher debt, lower credit scores, and reduced credit access for those who need it most, the American Bankers Association said in a statement. The Bureau's misguided decision to cap credit card late fees at a level far below banks' actual costs will force card issuers to reduce credit lines, tighten standards for new accounts, and raise APRs for all consumers, even those who pay on time. Another industry group, the Consumers Bankers Association, predicted that the rule change will benefit a small minority of frequent late payers and pass on their costs to the large majority of cardholders who make their payments on time. The CFPB has openly conceded that the majority of cardholders will likely see their credit card interest rates increase and credit availability decrease following a late fee cap, said Lindsey Johnson, who's president of the Consumers Bankers Association. Late fees have ballooned into a $14 billion industry as of 2022, the CFPB said, representing more than 10% of the $130 billion card issuers charge consumers in interest and fees in that year. The average late fee charged by large card companies ticked up from $23 in 2010 to $32 in 2022. Card companies will still be allowed to charge fees above the $8 threshold, but only if they can prove that higher fees are necessary to cover their actual collection costs. The new rule will take effect 60 days after it's published in the Federal Register. President Joe Biden planned to highlight the proposal, along with other efforts to reduce costs to Americans, at a meeting of his competition council on Tuesday. The Democratic president is forming a new strike force to crack down on illegal and unfair pricing on things like groceries, prescription drugs, health care, housing, and financial services. The strike force will be led by the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, according to a White House statement. Americans held more than $1.05 trillion on their credit cards in the third quarter of 2023, a record, and a figure certain to grow once the fourth quarter data is released by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp next month. Those balances are now carrying interest on them, which is the highest it's been since the Federal Reserve started tracking the data back in the 1990s. Supreme Court pauses Texas migrant arrest law by Maureen Grope and Lauren Villagran in Washington. The Supreme Court on Monday weighed in on the latest border dispute between Texas and the Biden administration, keeping a controversial state law from going into effect, for now, while it's being challenged. The Texas law empowers state law enforcement to detain and deport migrants entering or living in the U.S. illegally. Swiftly responding to an emergency appeal from the Justice Department that's filed on Monday afternoon, the High Court said it would keep the law on hold until at least March 13th. It was the latest development in a rapid burst of activity challenging the law, and it's part of a larger, high-pitched battle between Texas and the Biden administration over enforcement at the southern border. Texas Governor Greg Abbott argues that the federal government isn't doing its job amid record crossings. His border crackdown also includes programs to bus migrants out of state and put razor wire barriers in the Rio Grande. U.S. District Judge David Allen Ezra on Friday preliminarily prevented Texas from enforcing the law, writing, "States may not exercise immigration enforcement power except as authorized by the federal government." He added, "Surges in immigration do not constitute an invasion, quote unquote, within the meaning of the Constitution, nor is Texas engaging in war by enforcing SB 4. 2 days later, a panel of judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit granted Texas's request to intervene, gave the Biden administration a week to get the Supreme Court to decide if the law should go into effect while litigation is ongoing. It meant the law would go into effect March 9th unless the Supreme Court intervened. The Supreme Court on Monday extended that deadline and gave Texas until March 11th to tell the justices why the law should not remain on hold. The law would create chaos, quote unquote, in the federal government's efforts to administer federal immigration law in Texas, the Justice Department said in its emergency appeal. The department called the law flatly inconsistent with the High Court's past decisions, which recognized that the power to admit and remove non-citizens lies solely with the federal government. Moreover, allowing Texas to deport migrants to Mexico, the Justice Department told the Supreme Court would have significant and immediate adverse effects on the U.S. relationship with Mexico, a relationship critical to the federal government's ability to effectively address immigration at the southwest border. In addition to the federal government, the laws being challenged by El Paso County and Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, which provides pro bono legal representation to asylum seekers and other immigrants. Border community leaders and immigrant advocates say the law will unfairly target their majority Hispanic communities. Texas border communities live by the coming and going of U.S. and Mexico residents who crisscross lawfully to visit family, go to school, or do business. Marisa Limon Garza, executive director of Las Americas, said she's worried the law will lead to racial profiling. Abbott and the bill's legislative authors say state troopers won't target longtime residents of Texas, but only those suspected of crossing illegally within the border zone. Although how they will know who may be suspected of that versus a longtime liver or resident of Texas will probably come from stopping and searching them. And with that, we have come to the end of our reading of today's Cape Cod Times. Today's date is Wednesday, March 6th of 2024. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after yourselves, look after others. Remember our veterans. Bye for now.